The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In the book, The Medici Effect, author Franz Johansson argues that innovation occurs at the intersection of multiple fields, disciplines, and cultures. The name is inspired by the wealthy Medici family, whose patronage drew scientists, painters, poets, artisans, and philosophers to Florence, Italy, between the 13th and 17th centuries. The premise of the book is that bringing talented people from diverse disciplines, perspectives, and even cultures to collaborate brings about sometimes disruptive innovation, much like the Renaissance. Few people would categorize artificial intelligence as the upcoming Renaissance. AI has inspired everything from cautious optimism to downright dread. Stephen Hawking's final measure in a posthumously published book called Brief Answers to the Big Questions was this: if robots don't get us, climate change will. So far, one can argue he has gotten 50% right. So if we are to avoid the potential downsides or calamities that AI has in store, perhaps we need to look at the problem with a fresh perspective, perhaps even encourage a Medici effect. One could argue our guest does just that. Dr. Colin Garvey is a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation and at Stanford University's Institute for Human-Centered AI. Trained in the interdisciplinary field of science and technology studies, his research examines technological risk governance through the lens of political decision theory, using artificial intelligence as a case study to understand how societies can more safely, fairly, and wisely steer controversial socio-technical systems. Simply put, Colin advocates mapping the risks of AI into various domains such as political, military, economic, psychosocial, and existential, and offers strategies for improving the intelligence of decision making. His perspective is informed by his rather unique background. He is also a Zen Buddhist monk. Welcome, Colin.
Indeed, welcome.
Thank you, Alexa and Leslie. Glad to be here.
Great. So let's start with the last bit first. After graduating from college, you went to Japan to teach English and stayed there for 4 years. How did that influence you to become a Zen Buddhist monk?
Yeah, I was in my early 20s and had kind of an epiphany after I had been there for a couple years teaching and sort of living my life. I realized I had left behind all my friends and family and was living as a stranger in a strange land and wasn't necessarily happy the way I imagined I would be once I achieved that dream. And so one thing sort of led to another, and I remembered, I had always been very interested in Zen Buddhism. Is that not why I came here and did this? What am I doing? And so that's when I set out to find a teacher. And when I did begin to look in earnest, it turned out he was only living about 15 minutes away from my house. So when the student was finally ready, the teacher appeared.
Uh-huh. And so how would you say that Zen Buddhism impacts the perspective that you bring to artificial intelligence?
Sure. That's a great question. And one response I get a lot is people assume my approach is to, as one of my friends put it, you study people who are making minds, so don't you want to make them more mindful? with meditation or Zen Buddhism. And that is not the approach I take. There are corporate wellness seminars on mindfulness. Anyone can do exactly what they're going to do and do it more mindfully. I see Buddhism as a much broader, encompassing worldview. And central to that is the reduction or elimination of suffering, both in oneself and, you know, at an extreme, all sentient beings in the universe. And I have experienced a lot of suffering myself, and most of the people I'm familiar with who have come to seriously practice Zen meditation and Zen Buddhism also come through the path of suffering. And so that orients my scholarship, because I find, having become kind of politically more aware, having lived outside of the US and then later in grad school, that oftentimes new technologies affect the, let's say, affect have-nots, the folks who are already in difficult situations, already suffering. It affects them the most negatively. And they, ironically, have the least capacity for affecting the decision-making agenda. And that's a growing number of people, in my opinion. And so I try to orient my scholarship around giving voice to those concerns. And so it's not that I try to speak for have-nots and represent them as much as, say, advocate for democratic processes that would allow those people to have a voice. So I can't say what they will say or what they ought to say, but I can say, you know, the have-nots, the people put at risk by new technologies, they need to have a say in authoritative decision-making. And that's essential if we're going to benefit from AI, if humanity is going to benefit from AI.
Well, that's interesting, because we will get to this idea of democratizing AI. But before we get there, you are working on turning your doctoral thesis into a book called Terminated: How Societies Can Avert the Coming AI Catastrophe. Just by the title alone, one might think that you have somewhat of a dystopian view of AI, this concept of suffering. Is that true? And if so, you know, what inspired you to focus on this as a problem?
Sure. Yeah, I guess partly I read that as like one of those injury lawyer advertisements, like injured, call here.
I have a hard problem picturing a Zen Buddhist monk, you know, as an injury lawyer.
Yeah. Well, in my past life, I was a comedian, actually. I did improv comedy for about 10, almost a decade.
Wow.
So I, by nature, am a clown, but by choice, a monk. So
you are a very interesting person. So do go on.
I guess I ask the question, you know, terminated as in it's a choice that we can choose not to be terminated. I should say, somewhat pessimistic in my outlook, because I look around at other what I call epochal technologies or epic-making technologies like nuclear weapons or nuclear energy, genetic engineering, even the synthesis of chemicals, we forget, was really world-changing development. And we might also say put television and the internet in there. And in each of these cases, great promises were made about the effects that these technologies would have on society. And I look around the world now and I see extraordinary income inequality, increasing psychological distress in young people. Suicide might be the leading cause of death by 2030, according to the World Health Organization. That just seems crazy to me. And so there's some disconnect between the promised impacts of world-changing technology and the reality. And I think AI, artificial intelligence, is very interesting because it is kind of a microcosm of that problem, in that in some parts of AI history, the very concept of AI was only a promise. There was no machine that thinks underneath the claims being made. It's gone very far on hype and rhetoric, and famously had two winters where disillusion with the entire enterprise led to a collapse. And so I thought I could better understand if I could better understand the risks of AI, I might be able to better get at this social disconnect between the promises of technology and the reality of benefit.
That's really a lot to take in, and I note you reference the internet, which is a subject that's been near and dear to my heart for a quarter century. And I would in fact argue that the best parts of the internet and its development actually came out of, I won't say a democratic environment, but a very collaborative environment. I mean, the whole notion of the internet where you have networks and networks, and the design is how to make them work together. And you know, the multinational teams of engineers it took to come up with and implement the ideas and so on and so forth. Although I won't disagree with the sort of pessimism over it failing to deliver its promises, you know, education for all, freedom for all, or whatever. Although I would largely say that wasn't the technology so much as, you know, when powerful forces got involved. And maybe that's exactly your point, is how do we identify those powerful forces, and how can we better wrangle those powerful forces if we want to see a different outcome?
Totally. Yeah. As a child of the 90s, well, I mean, I'm born in the 80s, but grew up in the 90s. I was, logging on to pre-internet bulletin board systems from my 14.4 kilobyte per second modem and scaring my mom with a big long distance bill. And
I remember those days.
Yeah. So I had great hope and was a very avid early internet user. But as you say, and I think many other people have commented as well, there seemed to be this sea change in the internet, maybe in the late 90s, sort of the dot-com boom. And as you say, powerful forces entered the picture and shaped the development, shaped the sort of trajectory of the technology's development into a very commercial direction. And when I talk to AI scientists, I get the impression that those who lived through what I call the second AI boom of the 1980s, where a lot of funding came in, attempts to counter Japan, Japanese AI with new AI, led to a lot of new work and breakthroughs. People who lived through that time think of AI in that area at that time similarly to the early internet. It was And reading a lot of the stuff from the literature from that time, I think there's something to that. It was much more interested in questions like what is thought, what is cognition, what does it mean to be embodied as a member of society, and some of these bigger, more interesting questions that I think have really fallen by the wayside in this, what I call the third boom, which really got going in the early 2010s with breakthroughs in machine learning. And I go to AI conferences and events now, and my impression is much more of an engineering ethos focused on optimization, potentially commercial applications, and delivering value to users rather than probing kind of these bigger questions.
When you say engineering, that makes me also think that this is obviously, you know, commercially funded. The internet initially was, you know, in the US anyway, right? There was a lot of government involvement, let's say ARPANET. Let's go to this, the issue of democratizing AI, where a lot of companies like Google and Microsoft, for example, are talking about trying to give people access to the benefits of AI and to address some of the challenges, but their version of democratizing AI really seems to be more economic. But I think what you're arguing is that there is a lot more to it than just the economic access. There has to be some political considerations. Can you talk about what you mean by that? And there's a framework that you use for looking at the risks that you think has been used before in technologies like nuclear power that you believe can be used in here as well.
Yeah, great. Great set of questions there. Starting from kind of the most broad, my orientation is to say that, in fact, to the extent that technology affects all of our lives, whether we participate or not, at a very kind of macro scale level, you know, potentially billions of people, and then becomes part of the fabric of life and constrains our behavior, enables some behavior and constrains it in other ways, that technology is best thought of as a form of legislation, just like a law being passed. And when you look at technology as legislation, something interesting becomes apparent. If I proposed legislation to say, put 47% of people out of work within a decade, there would be processes for deliberating that proposal, and hopefully opponents of the proposal, probably those who represent people who would be negatively impacted by the 47%
right,
reduction.
There would be economic impact surveys and
sure.
Yeah, polls.
It would be opposed, and my ability to make that decision would be checked. But if I announced a technology that would put the same, you know, have the same effect, I might be on the cover of magazines and hailed as an innovator, and no one would have maybe even access to the decision-making process to intervene on my choices. So there's this very big gap in how technology and legislation come to be enacted and built into our society, because we allow business executives to make most of the important decisions about what kind of AI will be made and brought to the market, who will be hired to work on it, what kind of products for what kinds of people. And that's good for some things and not for others.
So one of the key... I was just going to say that one of the key features of democracy, though, is having an informed public. So how do you tie in the notion of informed public with some AI technology is pretty abstract and abstruse. So how do we stay informed?
Sure. So there's like different levels of being informed. And my kind of baseline is you ought to be well enough informed to say, give your consent, right? The consent of the governed is one way to look at it. Another is to say, know enough to be able to ask the right questions about the technology. But really, I think what gets to the heart of the matter is to know enough to protect and defend your own interests, or connect with your representative to defend those interests. And so that might not need much technical expertise. So knowing that AI can do things like recognize faces and be able to identify your face and connect it to, let's say, a consumer profile that's been built up through monitoring your behavior online, knowing that can happen might be enough. You might not need to know how. And so there's maybe a lower barrier than I think a lot of people think. And on the other hand, technical expertise is often deployed by people who have it as a kind of social authority to deflect scrutiny of their decisions. And so what's really interesting to me about machine learning, though, and some of the techniques like deep neural networks that are responsible for many of the breakthroughs in this current boom of AI, is that they are maybe inherently inscrutable. So actually walking through the steps by which an input is mapped to an output does not reveal, even to the technical experts, the decision-making process at work there. They know how it can be made to work, but not necessarily how the actual innards are working. This is called the explainability problem, and it might be endemic to this family of techniques. And so given that there's this kind of uncertainty on the inside of AI, and then there is another kind of uncertainty on the outside, and that's the social consequences. So technical experts usually lack much social scientific training. As engineering education kind of administrators often say, our plate is full. An ethics course maybe, but they're busy. And this is true. Experts can't necessarily say with any kind of legitimacy to the claim that they know how AI will transform society. It's really too complex. So this kind of barriers of complexity on the one hand and uncertainty on the other do some sort of a leveling between technical experts and ordinary people.
So Colin, there are definitely, there are truths in terms of that engineers are not, ethicists, right? But at the same time, a lot of what's happened in technology and innovation has been driven by private enterprise. You know, putting aside some specific government R&D efforts. And the profit motive is a very, very strong motive. So from a practical perspective, how would you implement something like this when everything, you know, that has been in play is a very profit-driven, you know, processes, systems, people who come in and are employed, you know, within in organizations and commercial organizations. And what do you say to folks who listen to this and say, well, you know, that sounds great, but that really sounds like socialism to me, you know, interfering in the process of innovation and creativity.
Right, right. Great point. yeah, this one's interesting because as we talked about earlier with the internet, the government can actually be the funder and the source of a great deal of creativity and actually much more unconstrained than a lot of R&D departments at big companies. So I like the work of the economist Mariana Mazzucato, who has a book called The Entrepreneurial State. And she gets into the history there of how government funding is responsible for actually every component of the iPhone, and that it was only the private sector. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it was only the private sector that sort of put it all together in a a nice package, which
well,
is
DOD. DOD is really responsible for a lot of innovation, I think.
Yeah.
And it's the commercials, it's the private companies who commercialize it. That's your point.
Yes. Yeah. And so and her point as well, that they that venture capital on private industry often come in after the risky period of innovation is over to then capitalize. And in the 80s, laws were rewritten along neoliberal lines to allow that. So the Bayh-Dole Act and other reforms made it possible for public institutions to spin off intellectual property developed on public funds to private entities to commercialize. And so that's a much bigger area, but I recommend her work. And the history of these technologies also is a good place to look.
So your point is that this is not something entirely new. We have done this before in the past, and at least the constructs of, you know, government having a more beneficial, taking a more beneficial role, a more public benefit role, has been there.
Yes, it's been there. Okay. The military administered a lot of those funds, and so it isn't, I'm not saying that period is actually necessarily something to idealize. You know, this definitely had a hand in building the American national security state as well. But things have changed since the 80s pretty considerably, and most people don't acknowledge that. So I would say from the late 50s to the early 80s, there was a period, another scholar, Philip Murawski, very good on this, there was a period of nationally administered science and technology innovation policy, and it is responsible for most of the things we really are proud of today. So there's that. But we're in a different environment now, I really do think.
What changed from the 80s to now? You said that a lot of things changed.
Yeah, so a big part of it was neoliberal reform to laws like controlling intellectual property, essentially, where instead of, say, a situation where the government would retain rights to a new development and then license them out, they spin off the patents and the IP oftentimes to the researchers who were funded by the public, who then create startups. So Stanford University actually pioneered this model with Genentech and other genetic engineering firms, and then also with the first AI firms. So Technology was one, and then IntelliSys, I believe, was the other, started in the early 80s. And this was basically unheard of at the time for academic, you know, professors who pursue knowledge arguably in the open-ended kind of way to then engage in, you know, a private company was rather innovative. And now we take it for granted, but this was a specific development at the time. So yeah, this led to the startup culture, internet in the 90s, personal computer revolution. A lot of the startup culture has become entrenched. And so I think you're totally right to ask, how can the stuff of regulation or governance that sounds like maybe socialism rein this in at all? And I think one way to start would be by thinking about the profit motive from the private enterprise side as a motivator, much like the circus trainer can get a seal to perform amazing tricks by giving it fish. The government might also be able to induce industry to perform in ways that are more socially responsible and more broadly beneficial.
So using the profit
motive. One of these ways might be to...
Sorry, Colin. So yeah. Using the profit motive as a way to incent them to change their behavior for something that benefits the public, but still using their inbuilt profit motive. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. One of the central kind of features of my approach to decision making and the governance of AI risks is to say that the public interest is very hard to think in terms of, and it's very hard to say what it is. We probably all disagree, but we can still design institutions that cope with disagreement without requiring us to all get on the same page about what is good. So that's one reason I'm concerned about a lot of these AI for social good initiatives, is that they take a naive view of establishing what the social good is. Democracies for hundreds of years have not done it well. We just have mechanisms for coping around that, like voting or deliberation. Going back to using the profit motive, one way to do this is to set industries against one another using insurance. So I could imagine requiring AI developers to take out large insurance policies on new software in light of their potential social risks. And this would create a profit motive working in both ways. The insurance analysts would be incentivized to do analysis on the potential downsides, the risks, and the AI startups would go on doing what they're doing.
But with some back pressure from the insurance. Don't go off and do just anything if you can't get insured for it.
Right. Exactly. There's already a precedent, a small one, but I thought it was important. The British Association of Automobile Insurers warned the industry, the new driverless car industry, to stop using words like full autopilot in their promotional material because it was, in their view, confusing people and leading to more accidents.
Interesting. Wow.
And so those kinds of tweaks can help balance by using the profit motive.
So it's hard to imagine, but we've already had a nice long chat, and I'm sure we could chat for quite a bit longer too. But just by way of wrap up, if you look out 10 years from now, what would you like to see have happened in terms of governance frameworks for AI so that we can hopefully not have minimized the amount of suffering induced by AI or perhaps maximize the improvements from AI?
Sure. yeah, so I'd say three things. First thing is institutions, not ethics. So we've already got institutions for controlling technologies and making decisions. We could make better use of them. It might sound like socialism, but we already use them to regulate almost every other industry. So one example is the EPA. In the early 70s, we had something called the Toxic Substances Control Act passed. And that required pre-manufacture notification on any new chemical that was going to be released. And the idea was they would alert the EPA that would then test it for negative effects, right? And, you know, they prioritize really probably dangerous stuff and let other things go through.
Do we have to create a whole new agency or just for like AI or use existing institutions?
I would say use existing institutions is probably a better start. There have been quite a few people who have suggested something like an FDA for AI. I'm worried about something that broad because it can turn into the mission of consider everything. And so there have been several groups that have proposed something like an algorithm impact assessment or other kinds of impact assessments. Great. I think the EPA could be the right place to start it, but that would mean, you know, funding the EPA better, right, to give it the resources, because even in the chemical case, it doesn't have necessarily enough resources to catch all the chemicals. But Toxic Algorithm Control Act, I'd love to see something like that passed. Second thing, I would love to see authoritative deliberation. So there have been some interesting cases where in Canada and a few European nations, they've taken advantage of small deliberative group exercises like citizen juries, or sometimes they're called deliberative polling, different formats to get the citizens' view on AI. And these are often held over maybe a week or less, and people deliberate and get informed about AI and then come up with recommendations. And what blew my mind was that at least in Canada, apparently these recommendations are taken seriously by the legislature. And as far as I know,
because Leslie's Canadian, right?
Most recent.
I said, you're not just saying that because Leslie's Canadian, right?
Oh.
Go Canada.
No, I didn't know. I was so impressed. And my Canadian colleague was so disappointed. I didn't like know that about Canada too. So I felt bad. But So that could be, you know, one mechanism, but I would love to see institutions for systematically getting people's attitudes and recommendations and desires for AI, because way too often I think advocates of AI act as if everyone will just sign on once the beneficial systems are here. And that's probably too simple of a view.
Fair point.
And I guess as a last thought, in addition to more journalism, and I would love to see public interest groups like the AARP is not looking at AI with all of the protests and things happening now in the US and around the world. Really every group involved with civil liberties ought to be paying attention to what's happening with AI. I would love to see America, maintain leadership. It seems, I hate to say it's that simple, but in a way I am a patriot of the oldest democracy on earth. And I would love to see America lead with its commitment to democracy in developing AI going forward, and recognize that we've got hundreds of millions of brains here that aren't being tapped, or minds that have important input that's not being taken into account in decision making about AI. And if it was, I think things could be really great. We could get closer to less work, more scarcity, any of the handfuls of benefits that are often claimed for AI. But at a fundamental level, we'll need to protect against risks that it could exacerbate. And I think we do that by taking seriously ordinary people's views, giving them the time, resources, and information necessary to form volitions about AI, whether they want it or not, and then learning to build and extend where possible the institutions that will take those views into account in shaping AI. And I'm not sure that corporations are those institutions. As far as I see it, they are focused on satisfying users and customers, but
and shareholders,
but we need to be focused on citizens. And that's a different kind of face than your face as a consumer. And so they can be just as profitable, perhaps, maybe sharing more of it in tax revenue, but they have very good tools for serving their users and their customers. And these might be able to be leveraged in serving citizens. And I would love to see government take advantage of what's possible in that regard.
Great.
But yeah, that will have to take the political will.
Well, it's been certainly a fascinating discussion and really good thoughts to go out on. So I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it, Alexa and Leslie.
Thank you, Colin. Hopefully Stephen Hawkins is wrong at least on one of them. Hopefully yeah. Both. Right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook
and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.